For two decades now, American education reform has been obsessed with raising the performance of our lowest achieving students. And it's worked. National assessment results show huge gains for the country's low performing, low income, and minority children since the late 1990s, especially in the early grades and especially in math. That's the good news. The bad news is that America's highest performing students have made very meager progress during this time period. Meanwhile, countries around the world are investing heavily in talent development and particularly in their most able students. To find out if these nations might have something to teach us, the Fordham Institute's Checker Finn circled the globe, searching for answers, talking to educators and officials, and learning how leading countries do gifted and talented education. The result is his book, written with our Fordham colleague Brandon Wright, Failing Our Brightest Kids, The Global Challenge of Educating High-Ability Students. Checker and Brandon are here to talk about the book, what they've learned from countries overseas, and whether there's reason for hope that America might finally get serious about better serving our brightest kids. Join us for today's edition of The Education Next Book Club. Welcome to the show, Checker and Brandon.
Thank you very much. Be with you.
All right. So, Checker, to a lot of people, this just sounds like one big junket. Is that what this was all about?
There was some junketing on Fordham's nickel. Thank you very much. and a couple of generous donors.
A few nickels.
Yeah, that was before I took over the Fordham Institute. I want you to
That's
know.
That's true. Back when we were big spenders.
Yes, exactly.
But in reality, I had been to almost all these countries once before, and this was a serious look at how they educate kids. So yeah. I'm not feeling real guilty about it, just a little bit.
Well, and impressively, as I do recall, you did hit all seven continents over the course of about 6 months. Not all of them for this book, but certainly as a part of this process.
Gifted education in Antarctica is something special.
Yes, exactly. Well, they don't call them empire penguins for nothing, right? All right. Well, hey, so let's talk about the book. You start the book by making the case for paying attention to smart kids. Tell us, what is that case? What's the argument?
There's a triple argument, two of which we lay out extensively in the book, and the third of which you have been calling our attention to lately. One argument is equity. These kids deserve an individualized, customized education just as much as do kids with disabilities. The second argument is international competitiveness. The United States needs to build its human capital. And if we only build our advanced human capital, our future scientists and engineers and doctors and entrepreneurs, from the upper middle class, or from kids who are gonna make it anyway, then we are not doing a good job for our country. And then third is an upper mobility argument. If there's anybody among poor kids who's got what it takes to rise in American society, it is smart poor kids. And if we neglect them, they're less likely to rise.
You know, in that last part, I think that resonates with people. They say, okay, we care about low-income kids and not just getting them to basic proficiency, but the advanced gap as well, the gap at the high levels. But what about for those upper-middle-class kids, the white kids, the Asian kids? You know, a lot of people look at gifted and talented education. They say, it's elitist. It's just a way for those white suburban moms to get resources for their own kids. It pushes against equity. You know, at this time when our country is obsessed with all these concerns about income inequality, et cetera, how do you respond to that concern that this is really just an elitist plot to keep sending more money to the kids who already have plenty and who will do fine, as you said, regardless?
Right. We've heard the argument more than once. It's a circular argument, perversely. The reason that a lot of today's gifted education programs and classes are reasonably chock-a-block with white and Asian kids is because the system and the parents have looked after the education of those kids. The system has responded to pushes from their parents and they've helped the kids get into these classes and into these schools. It's been the system's neglect of equally able poor kids and minority kids that has led to fewer of them getting into Stuyvesant High School and the gifted education fifth grade classrooms and things like that.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about how our highest achieving kids are doing. I mentioned at the top that there's some evidence that in the last, say, decade or two, we've seen a lot of progress for low performing kids, some progress for high achieving kids, but surely not as much. Brandon, you guys dig into all of this in the book, including looking at the international data. So how are America's smart kids doing? Are they holding their own with smart kids around the world?
No. No, they're not. They're doing well here, and they aren't doing well compared to countries with whom we consider competitors. If you look at the international test, the PISA test, every OECD country takes that. And on all three subjects, at least 18 of the 34 OECD countries have more high scoring kids than the US does. Math is actually the worst, 27 of the 34 do. And you talked about progress. If we look at the domestic tests, yeah, there's kind of been an uptick, especially in math and especially in fourth and eighth grade. But if you look at our gains compared to other countries, we've actually gone down across the board when you look at any score, eighth grade or higher. Mm-hmm. Really, the only places we've made gains is in our fourth grade kids. And among that age group, we actually do pretty well compared to every other place. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, we tend to just drop off heavily.
Right. And that's for kids as a whole, but also at these higher levels. So, you know, we're getting some momentum in elementary school, maybe into middle school, and by high school, something is going wrong here. Something doesn't seem to be following through.
I was gonna say that our high school fall off applies to smart kids as well as everybody.
Yeah. So what's happening, Checker? What is getting in the way here in the United States, do you think?
Let's start with policy, which has neglected kids above the proficient bar for 20 years now. Schools and teachers get rewards for closing the achievement gap from the bottom up, for bringing more kids up proficient, and from paying attention to needy kids who aren't doing well. But schools and teachers, especially those schools and teachers with lots of poor kids, get no reward for dealing with kids already above the proficient.
Right. And so you're really talking about the No Child Left Behind accountability system here that said you've got to get all kids to the bar, but the bar is very low. But hey, you know, recent years, states have raised the bar. They now have implemented tougher tests. We now have growth models in at least some states. So is that problem going away?
Not yet. We've raised the standards. It's not yet clear whether we've raised the cut scores. We haven't yet got tests that are allowed to really go much above grade level, and so they don't do a very good job of tracking growth for high achievers. The new standards and tests that you just alluded to are, of course, new, and we cannot yet know what they're going to show over time by way of progress. I'm not at all confident that under the current policy regime, and it's not just federal government policy, it's also philanthropy is pushing on really only one kind of education reform, which is closing gaps from the bottom up, getting more more low achievers to achieve better. And I think there's also a sort of cultural aspect to it, part of which you alluded to when you went on to the elitist stuff. We parents of smart kids are almost embarrassed to advocate for their kids. Mm-hmm. Policymakers are likely to say, well, those kids are going to be okay anyway. Why should we pay any attention to them? So we've got a lot of reasons for this. We also, frankly, have been doing a pretty punk job of gifted education insofar as we've been doing it at all. Mm-hmm. We're very confused as to who is gifted and how to identify them and what kind of programs to put them in. And we are allergic to the things that appear to maybe work best. Things like acceleration and tracking of various kinds, and we are in love with
ability grouping.
We're in love with a kind that works not very well, which is differentiated instruction in heterogeneous classrooms, which we claim will solve everybody's problem, but it doesn't work so well.
Let's talk about that a little bit. Differentiated instruction. You hear the gurus talk about this. They say, well, what that means is the teacher has got to come up with a different individualized approach for every one of their students, which sounds really, really hard and is hard. Although on the ground, what it often looks like is ability grouping. I mean, at least in elementary school classrooms, it often looks like, well, the redbirds and the bluebirds are together in reading groups. So maybe that's just a fancy word for saying something that we're not allowed to admit to doing out loud. I mean, is that because you say, Brandon, that ability grouping is actually really important for high achieving kids?
Yeah, sure. I for this heterogeneous class to work, a teacher, right, has to pay attention and give attention to all of these different kids at all of these different points. And that requires a lot of talent, a lot of training. Mm-hmm. And teachers, especially here, might not have that. Mm-hmm. And even in countries where they do, even in a country like Finland, they have trouble with this too, right? Mm-hmm. So there is a big question mark as to whether this works at all. And if it doesn't, right, then the answer would be to ability group.
And I found this fascinating, Checker, that what you show in the book is really that this focus, this answer, it's differentiated instruction is the answer, right? Rather than grouping kids by ability level, we want to mix them all up and we're going to differentiate. And that's the solution. That you hear this all over the world. And you hear the same allergy to ability grouping. You hear the same allergy, the same concerns about elitism. At least in the early grades, in the elementary school and middle school.
Mm-hmm. You do. You also, though, find some countries that are practicing a different kind of differentiation, something more like tracking in the real world. And you find a whole lot of places that are doing it at the high school level, even if they're not doing it at the primary and middle school level.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's get our passports ready and take this trip around the world. How many countries, which ones, and why did you pick them, other than the fact that they also made for good sightseeing?
We went to 11 countries, partly because that was what the budget could swing. Four of them are in Asia, and they're pretty obvious. They are Singapore, Japan, Taiwan, and Korea, South Korea, of mm-hmm. course. Three of them are what we call Anglophone countries. They were Australia. We focused on Western Australia because it's a federal country.
Mm-hmm.
Canada, where we focused on Ontario because it's a federal country. And England, mm-hmm. Which used to be a federal country, but is now just England,
mm-hmm.
Because the other parts of the United Kingdom have separate education systems, too. And then four on the European continent. They were Finland, as Brandon mentioned,
mm-hmm.
Germany, where we actually went to two places because it's another federal country,
mm-hmm.
Switzerland and Hungary. Hungary turned out to be the surprise. We thought we picked these countries because they had high achievers. Hungary turns out to not do much better than the United States. Mm. And we actually, I think, misread the data before going there. Fascinating place, though. At least it was before they started building their current walls.
And it was on your bucket list. So there you go. That's good. All right. So let's.
Okay.
All right. So you started in Asia. Let's start there, too. So Japan. What are they doing in Japan for their high achievers?
They are differentiating in the public elementary schools, differentiated instruction. They claim that everybody in Japan is identical, and then they're increasingly tracking in the high schools, mm-hmm. where they have test-based admission to most of their high schools, including some super schools for very smart kids. Some of them run by the local government, some of them run by the national government, mm-hmm. some of them run by universities. In Japan, as in several of the Asian countries, there's also a underground gifted education program in the private sector. Actually, there's two of them. There are lots and lots of real private schools at the secondary level. At the elementary level are what the Japanese call juku, these after-school tutoring schools, cram schools, some people call them,
mm-hmm.
which you pay big bucks to send your kid to.
$10,000 a year sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. And if you want to get your kid into an elite high school, which is a test-based admission, in mm-hmm. order to get into an elite university, which is test-based admission, you pay big bucks for your kid to go to juku after school. This mm-hmm. is actually a form of unfairness, in mm-hmm. my opinion. Mm-hmm. If you're a poor Japanese family, it's a lot harder to swing this.
Mm-hmm. And yet, you write that Japan actually does a reasonably good job of helping to identify low-income high achievers and help them do well. So what are they doing on that front?
Well, I'm not sure that they identify them and have them do well. It's kind of unclear as to how they produce the results that they do.
Okay.
Part of it could be a culture thing. But out of all the countries we looked at, they might do the best at propping their low-income yeah. kids up into the highest ranks.
Right, because every country you look at, there's a gap. That the more affluent kids are more mm-hmm. likely to be the high achievers, right? But you're saying in Japan, there is less of a gap than anywhere else, although you're not totally sure why that is.
All four of the Asian countries did not badly on the gap. But keep in mind that nobody's doing super good here.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We did this in terms of ratios of how many kids from the top quartile SES get into the high scorers versus kids from the bottom quartile mm-hmm. SES get into the high scorers. In the U.S., in Hungary, the ratio is 8-1, 8 kids from top quartile for every one.
Mm-hmm. In math.
In math.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's worse in the other two
it's
subjects.
Worse in the other subjects. The countries that do best in this mm-hmm. have ratios of around 3-1.
Though people would say, well, that may be because their societies are less unequal.
Yes,
in other words, there's not the huge economic gulf that there is here in the United States.
Well, actually, out of all the countries we looked at the Gini coefficient, and Germany does better in this way than U.S. in all three school subjects, yet their coefficient's actually worse.
Interesting.
So it's a bit anecdotal, but
can't use that as an excuse.
Yes, it's not the...
it's not an adequate excuse.
Yeah.
All right, what about South Korea? Again, same thing, a lot of cram schools, the culture's explaining this.
Yes,
what do you think?
Now a lot of single-child families, because it's so expensive to get your one kid into university.
Mm-hmm.
And not only do you have to spend a lot of money on the cram school, you have to pick your child up at 10 p.m. and bring him home to do his homework for the next morning. There's a bunch of exhausted kids in South Korea and families that are obsessed.
Mm-hmm.
And one kid is all a lot of them can swing.
Yep. Now, I remember from, I think it was Amanda Ripley's book, that you see these scenes of the, you know, teachers droning on in the regular school and the kids not paying much attention
or sleeping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Seemed like the reason they were getting those great results had to what they were doing after school.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. The South Korean government is actually trying in a whole variety of ways to make people ease back on this kind of exam obsession. But it's still a crazy place. I mean, I was there the day of the national exams in high school,
mm-hmm.
and they stopped flying airplanes in order that they not distract the kids. The test scores arrive with police escorts at the superintendent's office. The people go to the market and buy canisters of oxygen for their child so that they can get really ready to do well on the test.
That sounds a little bit like doping. I mean, we joke about this, kids on steroids.
Yes, oxygen doping.
All right, let's go to the other extreme, Finland, which a recent Atlantic article described as home to happy, illiterate kindergartners, which I thought at first was an Onion article, but it was not. So Finland, known as this, you know, idyllic place of child-centered education, and yet they've got high achievers too. How are they doing it?
Well, they actually kind of have an invisible gifted school system, in that as you get older, as you get into secondary school, they actually have a lot of competitive high schools. Mm-hmm. They have even a lot of specialty schools. And to get into these, it's generally based on kind of grades, mm-hmm. But it's also sometimes based on school exams, in the exact same way it is in the Asian countries, which have this kind of cram school mm-hmm. identity to them. And Finland seems to be the opposite, but in some ways it's really not, mm-hmm. which is kind of surprising.
Yep. The exam school piece is still there.
And at least in metropolitan Helsinki, there's also kind of underground gifted program, even in the elementary levels, where mm-hmm. families move around in the neighborhoods where they know the school is good, or where they get their kid into a quote music school at mm-hmm. an early age because they know that the kids coming out of the music school get into really good high schools.
Mm-hmm.
There's a kind of invisible gifted education program that takes place. These are mostly public schools. And of course, the country is deeply egalitarian and affirms differentiated instruction like no place else.
Mm-hmm.
And yet people get around it on behalf of their own children.
Mm.
Those, once again, who don't do that well are the immigrant kids, the mm-hmm. minority kids. Finland doesn't have tons of those, but mm-hmm. it's getting more every day now.
And they also, oddly, have a pretty big gender gap to the extent that some people told you that a lot of educated females are having trouble finding mm-hmm. similarly educated male partners.
No, that's right. Tom Lovelace has pointed out that much of their edge in literacy is really about their girls. That if you look at the boys, they're mm-hmm. not doing particularly well. All right. Those of us at Education Next love looking at Germany because it seems like a real peer country to ours. Largest economy in Europe, big country, diverse country, federalist system of education, and has made tremendous progress since the year 2000. And they're doing pretty well for their high achievers, too. What's going on in Germany?
Well, they definitely had a PISA bounce after they discovered that they had low PISA scores. And that caused them to shape up in a whole variety of ways. The PISA bounce, however, turns out not to have done them very much good at the high end. What it did was improve matters a fair amount at the low end for Germany.
Okay, I'm mistaken. All right.
A little bit like NCLB. Germany is also differentiated instruction by and large in the elementary and lower middle grades, but has gifted classrooms, really gifted tracks within their high schools, the university-bound high schools mm-hmm. known as gymnasia. In a lot of the high schools, one or two classes worth of kids in the school will be selected very carefully through a test-based, often IQ test-based admission system for a souped-up program. In many cases, this is interesting. This happens in a couple other countries. They are reintegrated into the general population for the last year or two of high school, lest they get snobbish and think they're special. Germany, you have to keep in mind, is for historical reasons extremely sensitive about differentiating among people.
Yeah.
They're happy to differentiate instruction in the classroom, but they don't want anybody to think they're better than anybody else.
Right. No, that is understandable for sure. All right. Any other countries we're talking about? I didn't get to all 11.
Well, one practice is worth mentioning that we encountered in Western Australia and Singapore. And it leads to one of our recommendations for the United States. And that is the practice of universal screening of kids around third or fourth grade to see who actually has particular promise or is doing particularly well. And it's particularly important because there's a very good recent paper by a couple of young American economists about the way in which universal screening gets you a better integrated class of smart kids. In your school than if you wait for just teacher referrals or parent pushing. And so I was impressed both in Western Australia and in Singapore that they, at the end of third grade or fourth grade, basically test everybody in the country.
Now, couldn't we do that? I mean, we start testing kids in third grade.
We
could look at the data.
Yeah,
I mean, in Ohio, for example, we also know which kids are identified as gifted and are receiving gifted services. We're going to do a study to try to dig into that and say, you know, are there discrepancies by race or class between the kids identified and their test scores? I mean, you know, are there kids that for whatever reason are not being identified, but should be?
Absolutely. We should. And that's one of our strong recommendations. We've got 10 recommendations in the book and we don't have time to go.
We will get to them. We will get to them.
I think everybody should actually get and read the book rather than simply rely on this conversation.
Agreed.
But it's important to add that I wouldn't just rely on the third and fourth grade test scores because those do, of course, tend to some extent to reflect at a young age the families and backgrounds that you come from.
Sure.
But if you had universal screening based on the tests we already give and then you supplemented it with teacher recommendations and things like that for other kids they perceive to be able but maybe not yet high scoring, I think you could end up with a very interesting collection of fifth graders, let's say. Who are then given some extra opportunities.
Yeah,
especially if it's school-based, kind of like the Texas college, right? How they
the scholarship
take, right. Right, then you would take, right, the kind of top five from every school and then add five more based on, right, like a teacher recommendation. And then I think it would actually balance.
Yeah, if you took the top 5% of Ohio, you'd get a skewed distribution of kids in third grade. But if you took the top 5% from each neighborhood or each elementary school or something like that.
Right. So that even the high poverty schools would know that this is part of what's expected of them is to do something special for their highest achievers, even if they're not the highest achieving kids in the state. All right, well, let's talk about your big takeaways. One seemed to be that countries that do better overall on PISA, let's say, they also do better for their high achievers. It's unusual to find a country that has particularly high scoring high achievers, but relatively low performance on average. So does that mean that, you know, in terms of national policy, we should just focus on, you know, broad efforts to shift the distribution
the
rising tide lifts all boats?
We don't have enough kids in that boat yet to lift it, which is to say, we've got a sort of vivid graph in the book where we show what moving the curve to the right would do for the United States and for Korea.
By a huge amount,
ends up doing more good for Korea.
Interesting. So, but you know, you could say, look, with No Child Left Behind and similar policies, we have shifted the curve a bit to the right, but mostly we've improved the achievement of the lower performing kids. But it's come with some little bit of achievement for the high achieving kids as well.
Sure.
So there's certainly some on the left, especially who would argue, look, let's keep doing that. That's, you know, that as a country, we owe the most to the lowest performing kids. And then we'll get this residual benefit as well.
You'd get more high achievers, but you wouldn't get enough more high achievers in the American population by just shifting the curve.
All right.
Moreover, keep in mind the high school fall off. Which will continue anyway, even if you shift the curve to the right in grades 4 and 8.
All right, let's talk about that high school fall off. We kept coming up in our conversation. It comes up in the book, Selective High Schools.
Yes,
you know, everywhere. Checker, you've done a book on exam schools in the U.S. There's a couple hundred of them.
Yes.
Right? It sounds like in many of these countries, almost all of them, or at least a lot of them, and it's not just for this tiny percentage of kids, you know, who might want to go to a highfalutin school, but it's sort of everybody's paying attention to trying to get in to those selective high schools. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you imagine it drives kids to be working a lot harder, you know, in late elementary and middle school. Not surprising that perhaps they don't have the high school drop off because they keep cranking it out while our kids do not. I mean, is that what we need? Do we need, you know, dramatically more exam schools in this country?
It's one of the things we need is more exam schools, and not just in the high school level, because if you only do it at the high school level, then you'll have the JUCU phenomenon with young kids, and you will have upper middle class families paying to get their money to get their kids into the selective high school. We also need the equivalent of selective high schools for fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade. They don't have to be separate schools, by the way. They really just need to be souped up classes and opportunities within regular schools at the younger ages.
And the point is that these are particularly important for high achieving kids, that they learn more around these higher achieving peers. But also, I mean, what our system's been so focused on holding the system and the account and the adults in the system accountable, not that much for incentivizing kids to work hard. I mean, you could argue that the reason we have this high school fall off is that around the time that it really student motivation starts to really matter, right? And you really need kids to either decide to work hard or not. That's when our achievement hits a wall.
That's right.
And you know, creating, saying to kids, look, your future depends on you getting into these high schools and then doing well there so you can get into good colleges, perhaps would lead to more kids working hard on their studies.
Keep in mind the psychology of countries where in seventh grade or ninth grade, you have to pass an admission exam. And we don't do that for American kids going into high school, except for this tiny number of high schools for which they have to do it. The exam schools in the public sector and a bunch of private schools, which are also expensive to go to.
But the kind of odd thing here too, right, is we don't really do this, but we always do after high school,
right?
We have arguably the best colleges in the world, right? And they're all very selective schools. So we happen to do it.
The ones that are the best in the world are very selective. Right.
So we happen to do this across the board at age 18. There's really no reason why we couldn't do it at 14 or
although
nine.
Even at 18, it's only for a slice of the population, right? I mean, the percentage of selective college is actually very small, but for that, you know, for that group of kids who's gunning for those, then it has a big impact. All right. So we've talked about, in terms of your recommendations, you say universal screening. We've talked about that. A lot more exam schools. We talked about that. What else? What else should be on the top of the to-do list?
Well, so the exam schools, I think, is kind of an easy and simple fix, but it's not essential. It's not exactly the ideal fix, right? If you take 5% of kids, put them in a high school, and essentially say like you are the high performing kids, right? One, you were saying that. Right. Like you're attaching this label to these kids kind of across all school subjects when that doesn't have to be the case. Right. Like if you're good at math, you might not be good in other areas. And if a kid is good in one subject but not others, then maybe she doesn't get into this top high school and she's kind of cut off. So I don't think it should be so exclusive. Right. So the better but more kind of complicated approach would be to see who's good in what and kind of personalize the education for these kids.
Which is to say two controversial recommendations follow. One is allow for and even encourage acceleration, moving faster than you would think that fifth grader should move.
Skipping grades.
Or just taking sixth grade math when you're in fourth grade.
Yep.
Which leads to the other one, which would disrupt everything we know about American education, which is real mastery-based progress through school for each kid in each subject.
Right.
Instead of assuming that every 11-year-old belongs in fifth grade,
right,
let them move at their own speed.
Right. Very good. When you think about the American education system and you look across and you think about the reaction you've gotten to this book, is there anything that leaves you hopeful? Or is this going to be different 10, 20 years from now? Is America starting to realize it needs to do more for these high achieving kids?
Well, the not too subtle purpose of the book was to get this on the agenda. And fortunately, there have been some other signs of others wanting to get it on the agenda lately. Mm-hmm. So we're feeling less lonely, less like a cry in the wilderness here. I think that we're going to see some movement in this direction. It won't be nearly as much or as fast as we'd like, of course.
Brandon, are you hopeful?
He's supposed to be hopeful. Yes, exactly. Yes, I'm very hopeful. We can make this happen.
Good answer. All right. Well, the book again is Failing Our Brightest Kids, The Global Challenge of Educating High Ability Students by Chester E. Finn Jr. and Brandon L. Wright, published by Harvard Education Press, available at bookstores near you or Amazon. It is a really important book and a great read. A lot we couldn't cover here today, including, of course, all the charts and graphs that are hard to get at in a awesome podcast, and some of these profiles of countries around the world doing it well. Thank you so much, Checker and Brandon, for joining us for the Education Next Book Club.
Thanks
for having us. All the best.
Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterum. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.